Thank you. So, Zach, I think I beat you with the longest title of the session. The most important part of this slide, however, is to acknowledge Ari Jumppinen from Kansas State University and Ken Jones from University of Georgia, who helped out a lot with primarily the pyro sequencing information that I'll be showing you. The context of the work is to examine microbial communities in some old-growth Douglas fir forests in the Western Cascades of Oregon, and in particular to take advantage of an experiment that's been in place for more than a decade, where organic matter has been manipulated on these plots. I think soil microbiologists would all agree that carbon, the amount of carbon, the quality of carbon is likely to be very important in terms of the microbial communities. And so by taking advantage of this manipulation, which was initially set up to look more at biogeochemical processes, it gave us the opportunity to see if those changes over 10 years of manipulating organic matter inputs would have some influence on the microbial community itself. And so this is just a photo of the control, the natural area of this old growth Douglas fir forest. There were some plots which received twice the annual amount of litter, other plots that received twice the amount of woody debris, and woody debris is a big input into this type of ecosystem. There were other plots where the litter was excluded by screening, and that's of course where the litter for the double litter plots came from. There were plots which were trenched, and if there were trees inside the plot, those were girdled to remove the influence of below ground inputs by roots. And then there were plots which had the roots excluded as well as the litter removed, so the no input plots. So both increases as well as decreases of organic matter inputs were part of this experimental design. Now, we had done some previous work on microbial communities at these plots using fingerprinting techniques, techniques which are not as sophisticated or detailed or potentially discriminating as using the pyrosequencing technique. So one of the earlier studies done by Justin Brandt, a graduate student of mine, and Elizabeth Sulzman, used phospholipid fatty acids. And the part that I want to draw your attention to in this diagram is that the plots without roots, these symbols, were quite different than all of the other plots. And there weren't very many differences we saw about in the other litter manipulations. And this was driven to a large extent by a higher fungal abundance in the plots that had roots. Subsequently had another student work with me, Stacy Kagayama, who took a DNA-based approach, and in this case used LHPCR, length heterogeneity, PCR, and this first figure is of the fungi, and again, the plots without roots, very different than the plots with roots, and you might speculate that's because if you've cut off the trees and the roots, you've probably removed the mycorrhizae. She also took a look at bacteria using a similar sort of approach, and the influence on the bacterial community was quite mixed. So we have some indications from these fingerprinting techniques that organic matter manipulations did have an influence, and the purpose of this study was to look at that in greater detail, where we actually get some sequence information. We can begin to put some names on faces, if you will. So basically, the questions that I'll be addressing in my presentation today are three. First of all, have the organic matter manipulations affected microbial diversity? I've kind of suggested that it's affected composition, but diversity is a question that we weren't able to get at very well with those other techniques. Secondly, will pyrosequencing, getting a lot more information, actually show the same patterns or show somewhat different patterns than what we saw with the fingerprinting techniques? And lastly, because we do have the sequence information, is that going to provide us some clues about shifts potentially in functional groups that would relate maybe to changes in biogeochemical cycling occurring at these sites? So we sampled in the fall of the year, complementary to when these other earlier studies were done. We worked at the top portion of the mineral soil, extracted the DNA, went through the pyrosequencing technique, and we looked at both bacterial as well as fungal communities. And at this stage, GS20 technology was in place, and so all of the sequencing data that we have were roughly 250 base pair fragments in size. Now, these are the total number of sequences which we generated, roughly 10,000 bacterial and fungal sequences from all of the plots. You can see the sort of variation we had. The treatments are replicated threefold, and so there are error bars on these figures that represent that variability that we saw in the field. Those number of sequences at a 95% level of similarity represented about 1,000 bacterial taxa and about 500 fungal taxa. So first of all, to the diversity question. So just looking simply at richness, the black bars are the fungi, the gray bars are the bacteria. You see a lot of variability there, but there was no significant effect on richness of the numbers of sequences that we got, the number of bacterial taxa that we got, and the various treatments. For the fungi, there were much smaller differences, especially as displayed on this graph. However, there was a significant difference with slightly greater diversity, interestingly enough, in the no-litter plot, and the least diversity in the no-inputs plots, which perhaps would have made sense, more of what you would have expected. But relatively little changes in diversity when we were talking about looking at both the bacteria and the fungi as a result of those treatments. The next two graphs, I'll show you community composition. And so this is basically using, again, 95% similarity to define our operational taxonomic units, our OTUs, and then using ordination techniques to display this data. So in this case, the ordination techniques are using NMS. And what you can see from this diagram is that these are the two plots without roots. The control is right here. Those with litter manipulations here, and the double wood is over on the other side. So this influence of the lack of roots on the fungal community composition is similar to what we saw using the LHPCR technique, but the double wood also proved to be quite different using pyrosequencing. Now, the significant differences are really the double wood in relationship to most of the other treatments, and then these no root plots in relationship to most of these, which are clustered here in the middle. Okay. So we see a little bit more insight, apparently, with this pyrosequencing technique that the double wood seems to separate out. When we look at the bacteria, and remember before, the bacteria didn't show very strong treatment effects. Here we do see some treatment effects. The control is pretty much by its own. Most of the other treatments, including the no-root treatments, are clumped together in the middle, and the double wood, once again, stands pretty much alone from all of the other treatments. And again, from a statistical perspective, the difference here is largely the double wood from most of these other treatments. So this does give us some idea that these organic matter manipulations through the course of 10 years is influencing both the bacterial and the fungal communities, at least some of these removal treatments and the double wood treatment. So just a little bit of information on the names. So these are the fungal taxa frequency, and the table were the 10 most common taxa which we observed. And so this is cutting across all treatments and all of the data that we have. All of these are basidiomycetes. Members of all of these orders are known to be mycorrhizal in nature. And so those do seem to be some of the dominant taxa that we're picking up in these forest soils. We also looked to see which individual taxa might have been important in terms of separating out those different treatments in the ordination plot. And we found actually a relatively limited number. Of the almost 500 different sequences or taxa that we came up with, there are only about 9 that were indicators. One for the control, one for the double litter, a couple for the double wood, and more for the no litter. Interestingly enough, if you look at these individual taxa, there's nothing particularly remarkable about them that would suggest, well, this is a wood-degrading fungi. For example, we didn't pick up Fanerochaes in the double wood plot, for example. Interestingly enough, we had no indicators of the no-input and no-roots plots. And maybe that's because we had organisms drop out, but no one pop up there. Same sort of data with respect to the bacteria. And not surprisingly, the most common taxa found there were the acidobacteria. In this case, I've given it at the order level. We have some alpha proteobacteria, the rhizobiales, present as a pretty dominant one. The xanthomonads are gamma proteobacteria, and then the Burkholderia and the Hydrophilales, if I got that name right, are members of the beta proteobacteria. So again, a dominance of acidobacteria and proteobacteria, what people have often found in previous studies from soils. A greater number of indicator species in this instance, about 30, and some indicators for all of the different treatments which were present. But again, if you look at these either at a higher level phyla or class level, or if you get down to the genus level in those cases where assignments to the genus level were relatively confident, there don't seem to be any particular patterns where you'd necessarily say, oh, that makes a lot of sense that we'd see a lot of this particular genus because we've gotten rid of roots for a long period of time. So to take all of this information and come up with just a few conclusions that I think we can draw from it at this stage, and as others have mentioned, when you get this pyrosequencing data, there's an awful lot of data mining and examination that you can look at, and we haven't looked at it in every possible way so far. Diversity in and of itself, richness of these sequences which we got out of the taxa, were only slightly affected by the manipulations, and only in a couple examples in the case of the fungi. By and large, the information we got from pyrosequencing confirmed what we had already observed using fingerprinting techniques, but it was a bit more discriminating, which you might expect because we have a lot more data to work with than we did either through the number of peaks that we pick up with an LHPCR or the number of peaks that you happen to pick up with a PLFA profile. And lastly, at least at this point, the number of phylogenetic clues that we were able to get from the sequence information was relatively weak with respect to the treatments which we observed. Thank you. Yes?
Could you please elaborate a little bit more on your pyrosequencing assay? What kind of assay you use?
So the pyrosequencing, the primers were to the 16S ribosomal gene, and in our case we used the same primer set that Roche et al. Had used, one of the early primer sequencing, pyrosequencing approaches. And for the fungi, it was to the ITS region using ITS1F, I think, and ITS4, the pretty commonly used ITS primers for fungi. Is that what you were asking, or did you want something else?
Yeah, that's my question. But so you differentiate different types of fungi using that ITS primer, or so your purpose of using biosequencing here is quantify a specific type or just get the sequence? How long sequencing did you do?
So with this version of the technology, the sequence reads average 250 base pairs.
Zach? Why double wood? Why do you think the biggest impact is double wood?
that's a good question. And there are plots like this throughout the world. This is the only one with the double wood input, largely because of the ecosystem involved. And for many of the factors, other factors that have been measured at these plots, leaching and net mineralization rates of nitrogen, CO2 respiration, the double wood hasn't seemed to have too big of an effect, actually. In fact, the effect of many of these treatments is pretty modest from a statistical perspective, simply because there's a lot of within-site heterogeneity. I would assume that we are picking up organisms which potentially can utilize more of the lignin or phenolic types of compounds. Again, probably the better markers for that would be available would be in the fungi, and at least at the level at which we've looked at it, we haven't been able to see any of the well-known lignin-degrading fungi popping up as being relatively more abundant in terms of sequences. But I would assume it has to do with quality of substrate. It is put on the surface. We do sample in the mineral soil, so whatever change is going to get down through organic matter, probably largely leaching downward.
Is mastication of the material? Is it when you put the double wood on?
It's chipped, so they're still pretty big chunks, and those chunks are still present on the site, and they're added every few years, and so it's a continual input of these materials.
Yep.
How did you anticipate the impact of local government? I mean, when did you sample after your treatment?
After the addition of organic matter?
Because I think the UDI and the recent compression is very takes too much time, so I'm not sure so how much we have to wait to the...
Okay. Yeah, so we sampled in September. Litter fall, even though this is a coniferous forest, happens dominantly in the fall of the year, later than that, when our winter storms move in. So most of the litter additions occur during that winter period, but it is swept periodically throughout the year and added to the plots with litter. The double wood is only applied once every couple of years. So there would not have been a very recent application of litter compared to the time when we sampled it.
You look at the ratio between bacteria and fungi, trying to see the shifts in the microbial community?
So with the PLFA data, certainly you saw a difference in that ratio of PLFA to fungal PLFA markers. We have not done quantitative PCR on these plots, which you might conceivably use to also come up with a bacterial fungal ratio. Yes, please.
How the manipulations affect the soil conditions, and how do you think that will affect the composition of the microbial community?
Right. So the changes that have been observed from some of the biogeochemical processes, relatively minimal differences in respiration rate, actually, a little bit lower, as you might expect, where roots are excluded. There's somewhat greater leaching that comes out of the root-free plots of DOC and DON, as you might expect. When we've done lab incubations, we see no differences, at least statistical differences, in rates of gross nitrification. Well, actually, there's little nitrification at these sites, in gross nitrogen mineralization or immobilization. You do see a decline in respiration in the plots where either litter or roots have been excluded if you do a laboratory incubation. Really, one of the most noticeable things if you go out in the plots is if you go to the no-input plot, the structure of the soil is completely different to where you have plants growing or you have litter inputs. And that's just incredibly noticeable when you actually sample there. That hasn't necessarily seemed to manifest itself in a lot of these other effects that we've noticed, although, you know, we obviously pick up some differences in microbial community.
Questions for the other speakers?
Yeah.
Also, there's five questions.
All right, I just have one more for Dave.
Yeah, I'm monopolizing this, sorry.
You looked at ribosomal DNA, is that right? Instead of RNA?
That is correct. We have
I know you didn't do it, but I'm just asking you to speculate. We often think, okay, if we look at an RNA, maybe it would be more responsive, or if we were able to look at transcripts, they'd be more responsive. Obviously, decomposition, it's an integrated, long-term process. So I guess I'm just asking you to speculate. Do you think you'd see more effects if you were able to look at one of those more active genomic pools?
In response to these long-term treatments, because when we sampled, they had been in place for 10 years, I'm not sure that if you saw anything by looking at the RNA or at some other potentially more rapidly turning over pool, that you could, you know, I don't know if I'd be so confident that that's an effect of this long-term change. I'd be more concerned if one of Zach's rainstorms had come through, you know, two days ago and caused a change. And so, but to be honest, I think there's relatively little data that looks at sort of trying to compare those temporal patterns with some of these tools that we have now. And, so Zach's is an example of that. But, you know, I don't think there's necessarily a lot. So it's a pretty waffly answer. Okay, sorry. Thank you.
I just have a question for Zach.
more on the technique side. When in Schwartz's paper, I was surprised that they had incorporation of the OET, the DOET, into, I think they did the E. coli, right? Mm-hmm. In 8 hours or 12 hours or something like that. So when I first read that paper, I went back and looked at sort of the biosynthesis of DNA, and I'm thinking, what's the mechanism here? And if you look at the hydroxy groups that are in the nucleic acids, a lot of them come from the recycling of amino acids and other things like that. So I'm just wondering if you have any insight into what the mechanism for incorporation of the oxygen is into nucleic acids, and if anyone's done NMR to actually show that the OET is in the nucleic acid, it's not just structural water that's adhering to the nucleic
acid. Yeah, so we from Schwartz's paper, I have a methods paper that's coming out before the four ecosystem, and I did NMR, I did NMR on E. coli, and it's rapid. I mean, E. coli are really fast growing bacteria, and that's actually how I distinguish, you know, where the labeled versus the unlabeled were actually going. From the NMR stuff, it seems like it gets incorporated in multiple places, from the backbone all the way, and we digested this stuff down to nothing. And so we're working with the biochemist to talk about some of the pathways, and those should be in that methods paper. So it's definitely, it is in there. And then we also, one of the other ones was I didn't want it to see, there's a lot of isotope exchange with O18, and there could be some switching that's going on. So I took labeled DNA and replicated it up and did multiple exposures where I took fully labeled incorporated E. coli DNA, put it in 16-0 water, and did the same kind of thing, like a reciprocal. And sure enough, when I ran the SIPs, they were still, if you're created with 18-0 DNA, you stay 18-0 DNA. But that's not to say there could be some changes that go along when DNA repair or enzymes associated with that. So, but if you get incorporated in, you're pretty much going to stay that way.
To go on this question, how that, do you know if all the bacteria incorporate the O18?
So that was another one. I think they're all, you know, operate on the same path, the pathway. So I would say that, yeah, all of them have that potential. And since it's so many places, the one unfortunate thing that I think is, like, with SIP and DNA SIP in particular, they use cesium chloride as a gradient. I use cesium trifluoroacetate because it comes in a nice bottle. I never have to mix it up. It's always the same. And it's usually used for RNA, but so some of the shifts on how many O18 is incorporated don't really match up. So, but I would think definitely that everyone can incorporate it. And everyone, in the stuff that I showed, the proteas were, again, like the people who go make the bread in the morning, they just wake up way before the rest of us and do something. It's not to say that everybody doesn't respond in some way.
Focus mostly on the organisms that increase, but I noticed there were some that decreased as well. You didn't say much about that. And isn't that as big a change?
Yeah, no, and the decrease is kind of harder to get, right? Because if you look at relative abundance changes, it could just because these responders responded so much, but you didn't really respond, but you're going to be decreased just because others responded. Mm-hmm. So we have to kind of figure that out, and hopefully if we go down further, at a general level, we can start, you know, kind of looking at some of those error bars and hopefully getting some of those trends. But no, you're absolutely right. I focus on the responders because those are the ones I can say they actively responded versus the rest.
I wonder if, and maybe it sounds like you've done some simpler methods experimentation, that you've run an experiment long enough where you start to see what I call food web dynamics, where you start to see recycling between the primary consumers and essentially death of a cell and cannibalism by some other organisms.
Absolutely, absolutely right. Yeah, no, and this is the kind of stuff, that's why we kept it to 72 hours. You could definitely get more problematic because, you know, you make stuff, you die, you release stuff, you release carbohydrates that you made with 18-0, then you use those, so it gets kind of tricky.
Over what kind of, can you just put a number after 72 hours?
I don't know. We didn't really look. I mean, you would see that there probably could be. I don't think in any of our 72 hours that we got full incorporation of 18-0. So if you ran it long enough, you could actually see two humps. And in Schwartz's paper, he actually ran it an extra long time, and he saw another hump that developed over time. Again, I was just going for those short-term responses. I didn't care. I didn't want another hump to show up, actually.
Okay.
Any more questions?
Back.
Yeah, so 72 hours is, you'll definitely see some change as you showed, but that CO2 burst, at least in the laboratory, happens within, you know, minutes. And so I'm wondering if you also consider looking at a shorter time frame to see sort of the kinetics of this response over shorter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, since this was my first foray in a SIP, and it sounds a lot more sexy than it really is. It's actually pretty crude. I mean, it's a crude method, and for my first time, I was like, look, I know 72 hours, I'm gonna get a response. But that time series data, we also did a 24 hour, and you could pick them up. It's always kind of scary when you run quantitative PCR and it's really a small product versus, you're like, oh, I'm gonna spend $250 on this sample to get it higher sequence. Really, is it gonna really work? And so we just kind of hedged our bets a little bit and went with 72. But definitely, I think you can get some fast responders if you're competent with the technique. Which I'd love to talk to anybody about if they want to use a piece. Still needs kind of jumping.
There is one more question. Thank you for coming to this technical session, to all the speakers, and I want to thank also Dr. Marianne Bruns and Dr. Dave Myrtle for helping, suggesting speakers, and assisting in gathering this very nice technical session today. Thank you.